This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Oh, and don't we need a little fuel for the human spirit? I mean, it used to be in bad times, economic bad times, social bad times, that we could hug each other. That's not recommended either. So consider this kind of an international electronic hug, okay? You can pick us up conversationally on the Star Worldwide Networks. Hopefully you know that by now. After 19 years of doing this program, now on Star Worldwide Networks, Spotify, and iTunes. And this is going to be one of those shows. I really believe that many of you, at the end of the hour, are going to say, I didn't think I could do that before I listened to Doug Gehman, Pat's guest. But now I think I might be able to. Doug is the president of Globe International, a mission sending agency based in Pensacola, Florida. He, I am told, loves coaching and mentoring emerging leaders like you, helping you discover your gifts and your life direction. Doug and his wife, Beth, ministered in nearly 60 nations, 4 married children, 11 grandchildren. And Doug is the author of 3 books, one of which just came out, called Before You Quit, subtitled Everyday Endurance, Moral Courage, and the Quest for Purpose. Doug asks in the book, is this you? Are you ready to quit? Before you do, can we talk? And you don't have any choice because Doug and I are going to be talking with you for about an hour. Doug, welcome to The God Show. And in these days of infection and physical concerns, successful businesses are closing because of that tiny virus that is an annoyance, and sometimes more than that, to people in Pensacola, people in Phoenix, people in the Philippines, people all over the world. People who have worked hard, and now for many, they think it's over. So Doug, right off the top, I'm going to ask you to talk to those people before they quit. Doug, it's all yours.
Thank you, Pat. Great to be with you today. When I wrote this book, I had no idea of this year, the very month this book was launched, this time right now, that we would be descending into, maybe is the right word, into a new experience, for a global experience that we have never had before. And so that's a challenge for everybody on almost every level. In the book, I talk about 3 different kinds of perseverance through difficulty. The most common I call everyday endurance, and it's definitely an experience we're all having in a heightened way. Prior to the stuff we're dealing with now with this virus, of course, we had, especially in the West, we're very time-conscious people, and so we quickly get frustrated when we feel a loss of time, whether it's heavy traffic or a long line at a supermarket or something that's just not going our way and we're being delayed. That impinges upon our sense of entitlement. We expect our culture, our government, our society to run smoothly, and so when it does, we're upset. It upsets our equilibrium. So I talk a lot about that. The current situation we're in now is exacerbating that at every level. And while I personally don't know anyone who has died of the coronavirus, I do have several friends that are now fighting in it. One is in the hospital. I think he will be fine. but he is on oxygen. So he's not only dealing with what I call everyday endurance, he's really having to face some very real moral courage, which is another type of perseverance where you're standing for something in the face of almost what would be perceived as insurmountable odds. So it's a really interesting time that we're living in, and the future outcome of this, we hope, you know, but we don't yet know how it all is going to pan out.
So, but Doug, there's someone right now, I know, in your hometown of Pensacola and mine here in Phoenix. I've been here so many years, and I have seen the growth and the dynamics and the excitement of business people coming here and finding the answer to their dreams. But many of those people now have had what they consider to be a crushing blow to their dreams. Pick one of them, just anyone in Florida or there, or in Bergamo, Italy.
Yes.
Just talk to one of those people, because this is an international conversation we're having, who can't go back into their business. They've had to lock the door and put everybody else on furlough, or they've had to fire them because they can't do business with the public. What can you say to somebody like that?
Well, whenever we suffer loss, it's usually in one of four areas where we feel this deep sense of loss. I referred to one when we first started talking about the loss of time. It's an irritating thing. It can be serious for us, too, because our dreams get dashed. And when we think something might take 2 years for our dream to come true, ends up taking five, or it's lost completely. But the other areas where we suffer loss, and the one that's probably affecting people the most right now, is in the area of treasure. Our financial status, the things that we value, you lose your job or your business closes, and the thing that is immediately affecting you is this uncertainty about your financial future. Well, where is my next paycheck going to come from? How am I going to pay my bills if people don't have margins in their lives with some savings accounts or something that they can lean back on in the interim between loss of job and recovery of a new job or the business comes back? That's a very scary time. And so that right now, I'm seeing that here in our local area. People are losing their jobs. I have a couple of rental properties, and my tenants are calling me saying, I don't know if I'm going to pay rent. And so there's these immediate stresses that come on people's lives. And how do I endure? How do I get through those difficulties? The other two areas besides time and treasure is a loss of enjoyment. Life is not fun anymore. We used to enjoy what we were doing. Now we don't enjoy it anymore. That is probably less of a reality today, even though people's fear of what the future looks like, of course, robs us of being able to relax and just enjoy life. I know here in Florida, this whole virus shutdown happened during the couple of weeks that we know as spring break, when tens, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, come to Florida for spring break. College students, families take vacations because their kids are out of school. And 90% of that got shut down just in the past week. As a result of the fears by the authorities of a virus being spread in crowds. So the loss of fun, the loss of a vacation, maybe more minor than the loss of a job or a livelihood, but it still does impinge on people, and it rattles our world about the future, the uncertainty that we are facing.
What can they do about it? What can that business person do, though, about it today?
Well, you know, for me, as a follower of Jesus Christ, I have learned through uncertainties. I'm in my 60s now, so I have lived through uncertainties, loss, personal losses, loss of loved ones through death. My brother, you know, died when he was young, so I had that experience. uncertainty in the kind of work I'm doing. We're in a nonprofit situation, and income can be high, and then income can be low, and so there's uncertainty attached to your livelihood, which is common to a lot of businesses. As a follower of Jesus, I have learned that while I'm like every other human being, I'm troubled by the uncertainties of life, I've also learned that I can lean in and trust that God's going to help me find a way through. It isn't hopeless. I don't have to despair, but God has a way of giving you peace in a storm if you lean in on Him. And that has become a refuge for me. And what I, in the book, one of the things I talk about is one of the reasons people quit, and often the quitting itself is not just making an adjustment. You know, it's like I'm adjusting things. We all always are making adjustments in life, but it's really throwing down and going into despair. And typically when that happens, people go into unhealthy behavior, in some kind of addictive behavior or destructive behavior. And I found as a Christian that I don't have to go that way. I can trust that God's going to find a solution that is better than that avenue.
The name of the book is Before You Quit, and our guest on The God Show is Doug Gehman, whose brother quit. You were just referring to him dying at an early age. He quit life. I know, Doug, that it has to still be painful, that with a faithful family like yours, your brother decided to commit suicide. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you feel we have to suffer in order to persevere. He was suffering and quit.
Yes. Well, one of the things that is an attribute or a quality of perseverance, a feature of perseverance, is that it isn't fun anymore. Whatever enjoyment we were experiencing in life is now taken away, and it's not fun. I remember when my brother took his life, we were in Asia. He was living in Southern California. We came home for the funeral, and I remember in the airplane pondering all the confusion of why and, you know, what happened. I was 29 years old. He was 27, so I was still quite a young man. And I remember reflecting on a text from the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, Isaiah 53, where he was, the prophet Isaiah was speaking about this coming Jewish Messiah, this hoped for Messiah, who in his words was called the suffering servant. And it says that he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And if you think about the life of Christ, and all that he endured and went through in his phenomenal life, and then, of course, giving his life at the cross, he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And I remember thinking as I sat on that airplane flying home, 29-year-old, and I thought, now I know what it means to be acquainted with grief, because this heavy load of grief that I couldn't even explain or understand, the first time I ever experienced anything like this, flying home to sorrow. And I thought, now I know what it means to be acquainted with grief. It's like sometimes grief comes knocking on your door and you have to let him in. You don't want to. But what I discovered in that I came to know something about the person of Jesus Christ that I didn't want to know about him. And yet when I learned it and I learned how much God cares for us, how much his kindness is towards us, that he allowed his son to come into the world and live among us as broken people with so many hurts and needs in our lives. Jesus Christ lived among us and then ultimately gave his life for us. So he became a person of sorrows by identifying with our sorrows. He became acquainted with grief by identifying with our grief, and went all the way to Calvary. And I thought, later, as I pondered that and went through that couple of years of adjusting to this new reality of the loss of my brother, and it usually, you know, it takes, I mean, I think if I loss of a child, I've never lost a child, thank the Lord, but I thought about my parents losing one of their sons. And my brother was the youngest. We have an older sister, and my brother was the youngest, so I was the middle child. And the grief that I saw them go through, the deep sorrow, and yet how courageous they were, how they persevered through that and trusted their strong faith, strong Christian faith, and they trusted God through it. And I later, this is the thing that came to me, Pat, later, is I, with all that tragedy and all that sadness, I came to the belief and the deep held belief that God gave me a gift through that. Now, don't ask me to explain theologically, you know, my brother's death. I'm not trying to make some kind of case for it. I just saw the redemptive theme of God's goodness, even in great sorrow. He enabled me to understand what other people experience in their gifts, in their sorrows. And I felt like God gave me the ability to have sympathy and empathy for other people who struggle. And I came out of that thinking, I can be grateful for that because I became aware of what Jesus Christ himself had to experience as he walked this earth for us.
We have listeners, many listeners around the world who are Jewish. We have listeners in India who are Hindu. We have listeners in different parts of the world who are Muslim and a variety of faiths. Before they quit, what message do you have for them, Doug Gehman?
Well, I would say that in every difficulty, one of the things that we face in difficulty is there's something else in our life that has guided our life and has kept us on track. And difficulty has a way of revealing how much we believe that we've held on to and that's guided our life. And so when we face a difficulty, especially if we're aspiring to do something, we have an aspiration to do something, we have a vision to accomplish something, and there are setbacks. Right now, entrepreneurs are planning new businesses right now, and their business is being thrown to the wind. A difficulty like that proves to us how much we believe in something, how badly we want something. And I believe that in one way, difficulty then challenges us to dig deep and say, I am going to see this through. I am not going to let this current difficulty, however painful it is, to stop the vision that I have for something to be accomplished through my life or me to become something or to achieve something. And so the call for endurance is the call to get through this difficulty because we hold on to the belief that eventually the sun's coming out again, the tunnel will end, the darkness will be over, and a new day will dawn. And are we going to be standing up and answering the door when that day arrives?
Doug Gehman has a message for everybody, and a whole lot of it is inspirational. It's for those who are faithful, but that means so many different things to so many different people. The name of the book is Before You Quit. You and your wife, Doug, have done missionary work in nearly 60 nations. I'm an avid traveler. I love discovering new things about the way other people live that I didn't know about before. But after visiting, after preaching to, after sharing thoughts with people in nearly 60 nations, right now, you and I did not rehearse this, obviously, but right now, off the top of your head, one experience, the first thing you think of, that inspired you doing that missionary work.
Well, I talk about a story in the book, in the introduction, that I worked as an intern. I was in my early to mid-20s. My wife and I had been married a couple of years. We had a child by then. We married really young. I think, man, I was just a child when I got married. Some people don't marry, at least in the Western cultures of our world. They don't marry like we did. I mean, I was like 20 years old when I got married. And we've been married more than 40 years now. We have four children, 11 grandchildren. So, you know, we did okay. But we were working with this with this man. I called him WC, and he had a vision to speak to large crowds in one nation of Asia and to preach, you know, the gospel. And everyone that he talked to, I was helping him. I was just a young intern. I didn't have a lot of knowledge or experience, so I just followed him around quietly and tried to do what, you know, be his assistant. Everyone discouraged him. They said, this is not going to happen. These people have their own religious beliefs. They don't need your message. You'd be grateful to have 50 people listen to you. But he was determined. He said, well, I believe that God wants to do something special in this country, and I'm believing God. And he was a colorful guy, not off color, but he was colorful in his language, and he was determined. And I said in the book, I said, what he lacked in tact, he made up for in determination and big prayer.
And what country was this? What part of the world again, Doug?
Southeast Asia.
Yeah, it was
in the nation of Thailand. And and we traveled around with him. We bought a little white van. We didn't have any money. You know, I think we paid $600 for it. He did. And it was just a little broken down van. My wife lovingly named it Lazarus from a story in the life of Christ about a man Jesus rose from the dead, and my wife named the van Lazarus because we kept having to raise it back from the dead with, you know, mechanics. It was just crazy driving around all over the country for 3 years doing these little tiny meetings in dusty little towns with a little, I joke sometimes when I tell the story publicly, I didn't say this in the book, but publicly I said, sometimes it seemed like we had more dogs and chickens in the meetings than we did human beings that would wander through the dusty fields where we were preaching. And it seemed like we were proving over and over again that the folks that had discouraged us were right after all. And WC just refused to quit. He was believing that God wanted to do something special in this nation, uplifting the person of Jesus Christ. And so he preached over and over again. Finally, after 3 years, we went to a little town in North Thailand and set up like we had done innumerable times before. And the crowd started growing from that first night, 300 the first night, kind of rounding the numbers off, but it doubled the second night, doubled again the third night, doubled again the fourth night. By the ninth night, there were close to 20,000 people sitting in the field. All we ever did, we never spoke against any other religion. We never were disparaging towards any other belief. We just talked about the person of Jesus, some of the stories about people that he met and folks that he talked to and the things that he did and some of the folks that he healed and prayed for and healed them that are in the Bible. It's just stories in the Bible. We just told those stories and the crowds just exploded. I remember thinking after 3 years when the team kind of dissipated and we went back to the United States for a time of itineration. And I remember thinking, if WC had allowed the lack of money and the breakdown of the little van called Lazarus, and if he would have allowed the naysayers who had discouraged him to stop him, he would have never arrived at that moment in time where God answered his prayer and gave him what he wanted. And I tucked that away and said, man, I hope I can be the same kind of a person. If I have a vision of something I want to do, I hope I have enough of tenacity to hold on to it until the day arrives when my dream becomes a reality.
But after all that time, WC didn't quit, and I'm sure that there are a number of reasons why. But what about you? What about Doug Gehman? Have you never wanted to quit?
Oh, my, yeah. We started doing work in some other countries, and it's funny, I kind of patterned myself after him. You know, I thought, okay, it took him 3 years to realize his dream. I'm going to start my time clock now. I'm a stopwatch, and you know, 3 years from now, I'll be fruitful. Well, ours, till we got to some fruitful ministry places, it took 4.5. So at that that 3-year mark, I was beginning to be tempted to despair. You know, I was like, oh man, nothing's working. I make some adjustments. I don't know what to do. I went back to school, got some more education. I consulted with people. I talk about this. I say you go through this series of disappointments. One is disappointment, and then you go into a little bit of despondency, and then later you go into kind of not despair, but more like cynicism. You know, if you're not careful, you descend into this pool of cynicism. Things aren't working the way I want, and you just get cynical. We used to make jokes about some of the things we were doing because it seemed to be failing so badly. But in my own experience, if you don't be careful, you'll descend into that thing, and then you will quit. We got help. I got determined to get some assistance, and we turned things around. And after about four, closing in on 5 years, we came into a great fruitful time in our work. So, yeah.
But tell our audience, Doug, though, on a personal basis, this really impressed me in the book, about when you were tempted to quit individually, just as Doug Gaiman, out in the middle of the ocean as a triathlete.
Yes. So I that's been more recent years. I love to be active, and so I cycle and I do some running. I'm doing less running now today. I do more walking, but I still do marathons at my age. So one of my children was going to do a triathlon, and she invited me to join her on this triathlon. So it's called a sprint triathlon. It's about a 600-meter swim followed by an 18-mile, so it'd be about a 30-kilometer bike ride, and then finishing up with a 5K, a 3.2-mile run. So I'm training for this. I wasn't afraid of the bike ride, and I wasn't afraid of the run, but the swimming scared me. I'm an okay swimmer, been all my life, but I never really swam in deep water over my head. So when I was training in deeper water because we live near the ocean, and I discovered that when I got out halfway along a 600-meter swim and got fatigued, I would panic. I'm in water that's probably 8 feet deep, which, you know, water 6 feet deep, if you're only 5 feet tall, I'm 5 feet 10, but you can drown in 6 feet of water. And I panicked. I realized I need to help here. So I trained in shallow water till I built up my confidence. So on the day of the triathlon, I jumped in the water when my time came, and I started swimming, and there's this adrenaline that comes in with all the people around you. You're really quickly getting off your pacing. And before I knew it, and I was halfway done, I was fatigued and I was starting to struggle. And I thought, I was so tempted to just quit and swim over 10 feet away to where some of the lifeguards are posted in the water in little boats to watch over swimmers who struggle. I wanted to just forget it. I was panicking. I was hyperventilating. I was floundering in the water. And just before I decided to just throw it in and go and grab the boat for safety, I thought, no, I've trained for this. I know I can actually complete the 600-meter swim. I've done it. And so I just calmed myself down, and I talked to myself. I said, okay, just, you know, go into the breaststroke for a little while to get your breath. And I got my bearings again, got back into my swimming regimen and finished. And then I got on my bike and I killed the bike ride and I cruised on the run and actually came in fourth in my class. So it turned out all right.
I loved the story because I think that everybody can relate to it, whether you are a marathon runner or a ping pong player, you're still actively involved, and sometimes you're up against the challenge that you might think is just simply too much to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I have a private pilot's license. If there are any of our listeners are private pilots, you understand the difference between what are called a VFR and an IFR pilot. So I'm a VFR a certified pilot, which means visual flight rules. I can fly in good weather. I don't have certification to fly an airplane that's equipped with instruments in bad weather, using instruments only. But one of the things that I learned in the early days of being trained as a pilot was, when you're learning all the characteristics of the airplane you're in, you're learning its physical limits, you're learning its top airspeeds, you're learning about altitudes, and you're learning about descent rates. So you're learning the limits, the physical limits of the airplane, so you don't stress the aircraft equipment itself. But you're also learning to fly the airplane as a pilot. So my flight instructor was teaching me how to deal with your own human emotions if something goes wrong. What if you have engine failure? What if something happens in the aircraft and you've got to deal with an emergency situation? All pilots are trained to fly the airplane. In other words, you're in this, you're the pilot in command. Don't panic. Don't resign yourself. Don't have overconfidence and become cocky and think, well, I can get through this, and not be realistic. So there's motions both on the, what we would call the positive side, which is overconfidence and denial. And then there's the negative side, which is panic and resignation. They teach you how to identify those emotions in a crisis situation, and then have an antidote to it. So panic, for example, the antidote to that is to say, I have choices. I still have choices. What are those choices, and what can I do? And one of the things that I've discovered when people get into crises and in difficulty, for example, when I was floundering the water during that triathlon, was they quit flying the airplane. They panic, or they resign themselves to what might not be a necessary ending. They just resign themselves and they just fly the airplane into the ground. Or they go the opposite and become cocky and think, I can do this. And they're actually denying the realities they got. You've got to face some issues here and make some very serious decisions about what you're in right now and make some adjustments in order to come out successful. So I remember my flight instructor drilled that into me. Always fly the airplane, Doug. Always fly the airplane. You're in command. Never stop flying the airplane. Even if you have engine failure and you know you're going to have to put this thing down on a piece of grass or a field or a highway, fly the thing all the way to the ground and land the airplane. Boy, I took that away and said, that is a lesson for life for all of us when we hit crises, because it is really tempting in life to panic or to resign and not fly the airplane.
So you've been talking about piloting an airplane, and we've been talking about piloting businesses, whether it's in times of great prosperity and success or times like these, times of uncertainty. What about piloting a city, a state, a country? What about leadership of that type? Is true leadership exemplified by not ever quitting or knowing when to quit?
Well, I think one of the, you know, Dr. Henry Cloud, who is a great author and he's a great consultant to businesses. One of the things he says that's primary to leadership is leaders must define reality, which, you know, is we need to know what the truth is at this moment in our business or in our leadership role. We define reality, and that means when there's a problem, we have to define what that problem is, and then our job is to seek solutions. And that might not mean that we as a leader are smart enough for it, but we gather people around us that can give us advice or input that can help us find a solution. And that would apply to a small business with a team. You know, I'm the leader of a small nonprofit organization, but we have a team. But that goes all the way up to government authorities and presidents of countries, where we get outside consultation to solve a problem that we're in. Nations right now are having to do this very kind of work, where they're dealing with an unknown an unknown virus with an unknown outcome at this point and trying to get their people ready. And as my one daughter who's in the medical field, her and her husband, she said this before it got popular on the TV, is this flattening of the curve. You know, we've got to have separate people from each other so that the virus doesn't infect each other, and that flattens a curve and doesn't overwhelm the capacity of the medical community. It's a very wise strategy that feels a little draconian and feels a little bit over necessary. I have friends that comment about, says we only have 500 people in our area that are infected, you know, and why would we have to kill all the businesses? Well, the point is to flatten that curve.
You've traveled throughout the world, you and your wife, in, from what I read in the book, more than 60 countries. And I'm wondering, Doug Gaiman, and by the way, for those who are interested in the book, and you should be, it's called Before You Quit, and his name is spelled G-E-H-M-A-N. If you can't spell Doug, well, then you're just going to have to write to me, and I'm sending a tutor over to your house almost immediately. In Western culture, the values that we have seem to be so different than many other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. Prosperity these days, prosperity can be defined as how much toilet paper you have in your house. Let's talk about that, Doug.
Yeah, well, we've worked in a lot of countries where, you know, prosperity compared to the Western world is very much less, at least in terms of it being spread out over a large middle class. There may be a small percentage of people that are very wealthy, but then there's a very large percentage that would be poor relative to the rest of the world. One of the things I remember observing when I was in college many years ago, and I remember one of my fellow students commented about how people were suffering in poverty, and I had lived in a Central American country for several months during my college years, and one of the things I observed was people who are poor don't necessarily know they are poor. We only know we're poor when we observe others who have more than we do. So I counsel some of our people in our world who work serving in poor countries, who they go to these places and they're wondering, can we take our kids? Is it safe? You know, will our kids be okay? Well, we raised our kids in developing countries, and they're all in their professional fields, well-adjusted, doing fine. One of the things I learned, and I tell people now, I said, look, if mom and dad are smiling and food is showing up, you know, 2-3 times a day, kids will live in a cardboard box and be happy. Now, they pick up their sense of safety and well-being from the nurturing adults around them. And if you're providing that nurturing environment, they do need food and they need a safe, warm place to sleep. But if you're providing those in the simplest of ways, they're going to be fine. They're going to feel fine and be well-adjusted. So I think one of the things that happens in the world today with the internet, with communications now, and everybody in the world practically, it seems like, has a phone in their hands and they can talk to anybody or see what's going on all over the world. It's a great good. I would never argue that it's not a good thing. It's a great good. But one of the downsides of all this communication and information is we now have this opportunity to compare ourselves with everybody else, and it really undermines our ability to be content.
And you're talking about comparisons of appearance, comparisons of body size, comparisons on so many different levels. But we also have, particularly in this country, the unique reality that poor people in the United States can see people who are wealthy beyond anybody's imagination. The celebrities that are constantly presented to us living in the castles of the world, and they're not royalty, but in fact, in this society, they are. What does that do about the division in society and the inclination that some people say, I could never, ever achieve that level of success, that many cars, that many homes, that kind of fashion. I could never do that, so I'm going to quit.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I have to say about that is that the accumulation of wealth never satisfies in the way that it seems to promise. Life, the substance of life, is something other than the accumulation of wealth. I think it's interesting, while we don't hear that message necessarily from pop culture, it's ironic that if you watch reality television, and I watch very little, but I see just enough in the advertisements and the promos that the folks who are the stars of many reality shows who are very wealthy, that's why we like to watch them. It's because we're curious about how do the rich and famous, how do they live, and you know, what's their life like. It's interesting that in these reality shows, most of the folks in those shows, their lives are filled with drama.
Yes.
I remember one thing that O.J. Simpson said prior to the great travesty and tragedy of his life after he was accused of murdering his wife and then later went to prison for some armed robbery things. Even prior to all of that, when his reputation was still intact, and he talked on a television program, a very successful football player, and he said, you know, all the wealth and fame do not bring you everything you thought that it would. It doesn't satisfy the way you thought that it would. I'm paraphrasing his words, but he was talking in a moment of reflection, and I was so impacted by of his transparency and his honesty, by saying, I've achieved all these world records when it comes to football Hall of Fame. I have reached a pinnacle of wealth and success and notoriety, and it doesn't bring everything that it promises. So I think all of us need to come to terms with that. Jesus talked about that. In fact, one of the stories that I refer to in my book is a rich young ruler. Amazingly, the Mark's gospel calls him a rich young ruler. So he's rich, he's young, and he has a position of influence in the culture, in the town where he lives. He's rich, he's young, and he's a ruler. Life couldn't get any better in terms of the way we often measure life. He's got everything. And he comes to Jesus and he says, what do I lack? He said, you know, what commandment do I have to keep in order to get what you're talking about? And Jesus says, well, you know, Jesus almost plays around with him. He says, well, it's almost like Jesus said, well, you know, you really can't get it by keeping a bunch of rules. That's not the way it happens. But if you want to try the rules, here's a few of them. And he throws out a few of the Ten Commandments. He says, do this, do that, do these other things. And the young man pushes back and says, well, I've done that since I've been young. What do I still lack? And Jesus said, I tell you what you need to do, paraphrasing. But he basically says, I want you to go home, sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and come and follow me. And it says that the young man went away sorrowful. He didn't do it. He went away sorrowful because he had he had many riches, and he wasn't able to give up what he had in order to follow Jesus. Jesus said in response, he said, it's very tough for the rich to enter into the kingdom of God, because of their possessions stand in the way of what really brings life for people.
Did Jesus quit on the cross when he said, Father, why hast thou forsaken me?
I do not believe he did. In fact, in John's gospel, Jesus, before Calvary, Jesus wasn't taken by surprise by what happened at the cross. He had been warning his disciples in advance for a period of time. It probably was up to a year before he was warning the disciples that were following him, his inner circle. He was saying, you know, we're going to go to Jerusalem soon, and I'm going to be betrayed, and I'm going to be put to death there. And the disciples were like, no way, this will never happen to you. They were blowing it off and not really listening to him. And he repeated it multiple times in the gospel accounts. When he got there, or when he got to Jerusalem, he's talking to his disciples. And one of the times in their presence, he's praying and he says, Father, now is the time to glorify me. And what he meant by that was his death. He meant God was going to be glorified in the death of Jesus, in his being put to death on a cross. So I don't believe Jesus quit. I believe Jesus completed the task. That's a hard one for people to get their heads around, because for us, if we believe that life, especially if we are you know, a secular in our approach to life, and our belief is that the 70 to 80 years is all there is, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in the life after. If that's where our paradigm is, then death or laying our life down for someone is hard to do, because it's the only thing we have. For a Christian, or for a person of faith who says there is a life after death, then the life that we now have is not the end. The end of that life is not the end of all things. It's just a stewardship time. We're stewarding that time in faithfulness to God and serving him, because we know that another life and a longer and even more substantial life is awaiting us afterwards. And that, I think, is the essence of why Jesus could lay the life down that he had, because he knew that he was eternal. He came from God, and he was returning to God after having completed the task God gave him to do.
In the book, you refer to four types of loss, and you reflected briefly on it earlier in the program. So give us a little bit more detail, Doug Gehman, on the four types of loss and what we can do about it.
Yeah. Well, the first one is time. And I go into a lot of depth on time and Western culture's preoccupation with time, why we're so time conscious. That has everything to do with our daily routines. We don't like to be late. We don't like to be delayed. We feel anxious about life. We love youth because getting old means time is running out for us. So again, referring to Western culture's preoccupation, I think other cultures of the world have a little bit of a different take on that. And as cultures of the world that have adopted some Western values, they're beginning to experience some of that. I want to be a little careful by saying this, but maybe a little obsession with time. And so that one is a big one. And when we lose time, we struggle. The second one is treasure. And that's not just money, but it's all the things that we treasure other than human relationships, because that's one of the four. But things that we treasure, our homes, our cars, our valuables, our aspirations, the stuff that we treasure, when we experience them being taken from us for one reason or another, that is very hard. The third one is fun, or what I call enjoyment, pleasure. Western culture is very preoccupied with pleasure. And one of the questions we ask, whether we say it directly or if it's just an intuitive feeling we have in our heads, is if it's not fun, why would I do it? And so we have in some ways put the idea of all endeavors, all pursuits have to have enjoyment attached to them, or they're not worth doing. And why would I waste my time and energies doing them? And then the fourth one is a relationship, human relationships, people that we love, spouses, parents, children, friendships. And when we lose a relationship, either by something as tragic as death or by a betrayal of a friend, or something happens and a relationship is broken, we really suffer. We grieve over those losses. So one of the ways we have to deal with these losses, because all of us through life, we're going to lose in some way, or we will lose some times, we will be disappointed, we will have some treasure that won't happen for us or be taken from us. I lost my brother, a relationship. I went through times in my life that weren't fun. Either drowning, thinking I'm going to drown in a triathlon, to a couple of years when my wife and I, we were struggling in our marriage and it wasn't as fun as it had been. And we had to look at each other in the eye and think, are we going to work through this? Or are we just going to quit and believe that we can go find love in another relationship? And we had to persevere through the loss of some enjoyment in that primary relationship called marriage. But we determined we had made a commitment to one another and before God, and we were going to make it work out. My advice to people when you suffer loss is to embrace the loss and be in touch with the pain that you're experiencing and ask yourself some pointed questions about what you're going through and see what you can learn through it and how you can grow as a person rather than just reacting and quitting and running.
Well, this time of sacrifice, though, that in fact, in many cases, we are entering into, nobody has any idea how long this is going to last. But during this time of uncertainty and personal sacrifice, can there be some real value on the other side for all cultures?
Yes, I think so. I think, and it remains yet to be seen even how life will look, life will look like after we get through this time. I believe we will, but how will it change life in the short term and in the long term? Here's an example. Just think about a loss of a job. I know as for men, especially, we pick up a lot of our identity in what we do. And so when a man loses his job, he feels like he's lost his identity, especially if it's been something you were doing that you really loved. It's been a dream come true to do this particular job. And now we've lost it because of this virus. We're unemployed and we're thinking this job's not coming back, not anytime soon. Maybe the business closed and I've got to find something to do to make money to support myself. If I'm a father or a husband or both, I have to support my family. And men really struggle with finding something to do that they can enjoy and also make money. My advice, and one of the things that I've learned through the years, and I can't even say I apply this perfectly, but one of the things I've learned is you can actually find joy in doing anything. If you just make up your mind, you're going to find joy in doing it. You know, I do much of my work is brain work. I work with people and I work with information. And if I would have to go out and get a job that was just working with things, a road crew or a cleaning business or working at a department store where I'm handling, you know, selling car parts or something like that, I'd have to have a big adjustment. But what I've learned is if I make up my mind, I can go to that new job, I can be nice to the people around me, I can apply myself to doing the best I can do for my boss, I'm going to learn this department. In fact, you can actually enjoy the job even though it's a major shift. It has to do with your attitude and embracing the difficulty as an opportunity to grow as a person.
With 1 minute to go, and I think we could do 11 more hours and make this a special kind of radiothon with Doug Gaiman on the subject of quitting, making that decision before you quit. 1 minute to talk to that guy in Luxembourg that's listening right now, and he's saying, it isn't a matter of quitting. I'm a failure. I fail at everything I do, so why shouldn't I quit? Doug, tell him.
Yeah. You know, the famous German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, he who has a why can endure anyhow. And in many ways, it's amazing because he, in many ways, in that moment, agrees with something that Jesus said. And that has to do with when we find meaning, when we find meaning behind our difficulties, when we can search for the purpose, the meaning, and the joy behind what we're doing, we can do almost anything. We can endure almost anything, even though much has been taken away. And my challenge to everyone who's listening is to seek to find that purpose and meaning behind what you're going through, rather than react. Look for the why behind it. And if you have to lean in on God and ask Him to help you, don't be afraid to do that. Give this an opportunity to lean in and learn from Him as well, from an outside source.
The name of the author, the name of the guest is Doug Gehman, G-E-H-M-A-N, the name of the book, Before You Quit. And I hope you know by now that the name of the broadcast is The God Show on the Star Worldwide Networks. This is Pat McMahon. I'm not quitting. How about you?